Get road trip ready with a service checkup at your local Chevy dealer. They can save you time and money and get the job done right the first time, worry-free. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for current service specials or to schedule a test drive.
Happy Thursday, and it's me, Anna D. Anna DeVlantis, from our studios high above Columbus and Wacker Drive. Hey, up until about 45 minutes ago, you were listening to President Trump's speech here on WGN Radio, the live broadcast of the president speaking the first time after his acquittal in the impeachment trial. And maybe you heard it, maybe you didn't. We had a number of people say they heard too much of it, they were telling us on the text line, but it was a defiant President Trump defending himself, lashing out at his political opponents and sparing no one, lying Democrats. James Comey was mentioned by name, the FBI, the media. At one point, he held up a copy of the Washington Post and said, "This is the only good headline I've ever seen about myself." It was Trump acquitted. So that's what happened. There was the point, though, that made most of us kind of perk up a little bit and sit up in our chairs. And you didn't hear this on our broadcast because our producer, who was working at the time, caught it. The president used a bad word in his speech. She used a swear word, one you don't often hear a president say, and at least not publicly, for sure. It's the one that starts with bull, and I'm not going to say it now, but I had a couple of us reaching for the FCC rule book just to make sure that was okay. Was that okay? I don't know. I don't think there'll be a fine or anything like that. But anyway, that happened. Coming up on the show, today is the day the new e-cigarette vaping laws take effect. The flavor ban, those flavors that are supposed to appeal more to the younger users. We're going to find out more about that, Ryan Burrow, in just a minute here. He's stepped into the studio. Will it help or hurt the situation? Because I think there's an argument for both. Could hurt the situation? Does it send things to the black market? Or is this really just going to be a good thing overall? We'll talk about that. Also on the show, Naperville cracks down on dog sales, those that come from commercial breeders. Can't sell them at pet stores. Is that a good idea? We'd like to hear from you on that, especially if you bought a pet from a pet store. How'd it work out for you? How did things go? Chicago has a ban, but we'll talk about this coming up in the segment. The ban, there are many, many loopholes in the way they worded the ban here so that you'll see commercial breeding dogs at pet stores. It didn't really have a lot of teeth in that bill, so we'll talk about that. Then the movement to make a Chicago area woman a saint, a controversial figure. Dorothy Day grew up in the Depression times here, the Depression era here in Chicago. She was mentioned by Pope Francis as one of the most important figures of her time. Stood up for working people, but highly controversial, as I mentioned. There's a new documentary, and so they're premiering it tonight here in Chicago. We're going to talk to the filmmaker about Dorothy Day and that movement to canonize her. But let's get to Ryan Burrow, shall we? Ryan?
Sure.
Did you hear what the president said earlier?
I did. Mm-hmm. I heard it live and in real time.
Yep. Did you kind of like, whoa,
yeah.
Whoa, what did he do?
Exactly.
Did he just say that?
Yep.
That's how I responded.
Yeah, you know, we're always obviously doing other things.
Sure,
you know,
right.
When this
Ten
is going
things.
On, but there's the TV in the corner, you're kind of half listening, and then you hear that word, and you're like, oh, wait a minute here.
Yeah, and the other thing is, before we get to the actual subject you're here to talk about, which is the e-cigarettes, is this other thing, looking at my Twitter right now, Bernie Sanders claiming we won in Iowa because of the unprecedented grassroots effort of our campaign, and he's claiming victory in Iowa. Do we have an actual victory?
We don't. We're still at 97%, and there will be a re-canvass. It looks like the DNC is calling for a re-canvass. They've got a full policy in place. They will recount every vote that was taken in from all of these precincts, and there's nothing they can do to validate whether, you know, someone erroneously voted. They can't do that, but they can take a look at the numbers again. The numbers, you know, Bernie Sanders can claim victory. That's fine. I mean, look, it's him and Mayor Pete Buttigieg. That they were the two that walked away, and they will have the most delegates. And let's keep this in perspective, too. The delegates that we're talking about are less than 2% of the delegates that will be at the convention. You know, I mean, but it gives you some wind in your sails going into the next.
It's the first one. And Iowa matters in the past. It always has.
And it's a victory for Mayor Pete and Senator Sanders, no question, and not necessarily a good day for Joe Biden.
So they're going back and they're redoing it again. This is this, they have most of them, and it's really close, but they've got to, I heard them, Tom Perez, the head of the DNC, say, well, no, we're going to go back and go
just
through
they
this.
They just want to make sure that everything is right and set, because nothing went the way they wanted to, so they're going to check everything all over again. The way it's shaping up right now in New Hampshire, we're seeing some polling, Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, once again. One and two, so... It does have an impact, and it's not exactly the start that the Democrats wanted getting into this campaign season, but here we are.
Yeah, and is Biden far behind in that poll you saw? Do you remember?
In the New Hampshire one, he is pulling in third, just ahead of Elizabeth Warren. I don't know how many percentage points.
Okay.
We still got a week to go, so
just
a lot can change.
Finally, no idea exactly when we'll know the Iowa final vote tally announcement.
It's been so weird.
The first day they
released it, it was 62%, and then we went up to 71%, and then 75%, and now we're at 97%. It's like, just come on, let's get to it.
I mean,
how hard? I've been seeing a lot of memes on Facebook now saying they need to call in count from Sesame Street to go and finish
one,
the job here.
Two,
yeah, right?
Yes.
Exactly.
He could do that. I bet he could. All right. So you really are covering e-cigarettes here. So today is an important day. If something goes into effect, there's a ban.
Yeah. This week is the week when the e-cigarette ban, the flavored e-cigarette ban goes into effect. This was brought down by the federal government. It was something the president had pushed for. And really, we've heard from both sides of the aisle that both sides wanted to move on this because of the epidemic that we saw with vaping among the youth. And the thought is, let's pull down these flavors that are enticing the youth, the lemonade, the strawberry, the vanilla, the cream, those kind of flavors. And let's do an all-out ban on that. Let's make sure these companies like Juul, some of these other companies, go and recertify these flavors through the FDA and make sure they're safe before they start selling them on the shelf. So this is by no means a permanent ban. It's just something that's a temporary ban until they get everything registered. But there's been a loophole that people have pointed to, and that's one of the reasons the House Energy and Commerce...
Let me hold you right there, because we're going to just pause for a moment and pick it up right there. You said the loophole in the flavor, it's not a ban, it's a temporary holding pattern for the flavors as they research things, as Ryan Burrow from ABC News and WGN Radio News has just told us about. We'll be right back with that in a second here on WGN Radio. More to come. All right, back to the snow globe here on the 18th floor of the WGN Skyline Studios. It's me, Anna, and Ryan Burrow is here from ABC News and WGN Radio News. We're talking about what's happening with e-cigarettes. We've heard so many stories about what's going on with teenage use, and we've seen a lot of kids end up in hospitals and a lot of surprised parents who said, gee, I didn't even know a thing about this until this suddenly became a health crisis. And so then we got to the point where lawmakers said, let's do something. What are they doing, Ryan?
Well, the Trump administration has called for a ban on flavored e-cigarettes, which the U.S. government is doing this week. But there's a loophole. The idea is if you ban the flavored e-cigarettes, it would prevent more teens from getting involved with these. It's the flavors that entice them. That's what some people are saying, and the government tends to agree, whether it be the way that they were marketed or the kind of flavors they have. Let's get rid of that. Let's end this epidemic, and let's get back to what these e-cigarettes were made to do, wean people off of cigarette smoking adults. Mm-hmm. Off of cigarette smoking.
That's what they were intended to be in the
beginning. Not create a new generation of nicotine users, but to help wean people off of cigarettes as a healthier version, although there's some debate as to whether they are healthier or not.
Mm-hmm.
There's a loophole in this flavored e-cigarette ban, and that is that disposable e-cigarettes are not part of it. Now, the way that the e-cigarette works is it can be rechargeable, it can be refillable. So you can get one e-cigarette, I think that costs like $40 or something like that, and then you fill them up with whatever flavor, and then you can recharge it and reuse it and then fill it up with another flavor. The disposables, I believe, are about $10, and these one-time use, can't recharge them, you throw them away when you're done. Those will not have any restrictions on them. And people are saying, well, wait a minute here.
That doesn't make sense.
If you want to get rid of this and you want kids to stop using them, don't allow the disposable ones to still be up on the market. And what we saw yesterday at the House Energy and Commerce Committee was questions on exactly that to the heads of these e-cigarette companies saying, you know, how is this possible? You know, that we might be in the exact same problem we were in before. And the companies say, you know, their statistics, their data shows that no that youth aren't drawn to the disposables.
Oh, that's interesting.
At least to this point.
Speaking of statistics, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, who's been out front on this issue, mm-hmm. he's been outspoken. His stats, he says in Illinois, 25% of high schoolers vape, 10% of middle schoolers vape.
That scary stuff.
Scary high numbers, I would say.
I've got a 12-year-old.
You do?
Yeah.
You don't have to say does, but do his friends, her friends?
No. I think we'd have a pretty good handle on it, but I guess I can never know for sure. But some of the things that she said indicate that she has no interest in it, but, you know. Yeah. We'll see moving forward. She's 12 now. Let's see what she's saying when she's 14, 16.
Yeah, that's the thing. The congressman, in fact, brought as his guest to the State of the Union address a local woman, Ruby Johnson. She's been on our show. She's a new Lennox mom who said she didn't know what vaping was. She thought these were like thumb drives in her daughter's room. She had no idea what they were. And then suddenly, you know, she's taking her daughter back to college, driving her there, and she's having lung problems, ends up in the hospital, and it was pretty scary. She's now become an advocate to try to just get the word out to parents about them and the dangers and kind of what to look for. I just, the concern I always hear whenever they talk about cracking down on them, whether it's the flavors or just in general or trying to restrict them from teenagers getting them, you just wonder if it leaves, if you're going to send them to the black market.
Yes.
Because it seems so many of the problems we've heard of already have come from black market deals, the ones that are laced with THC or God knows what that they're putting in them, that those boys in Wisconsin, is there a 20-something-year-old, two brothers, mm-hmm. they found a bunch of these pods that were totally illegal. They'd just injected them with what, I guess THC, whatever they put in them, and a ton of kids were getting sick off those. Those weren't exactly ones you were buying officially or at a gas station or anything like that. Those were the ones that they're just kind of producing.
And that's the argument from the vaping industry, and I put that in quotes because essentially we're talking about the makers of these e-cigarettes as well as the sellers at some of these, you know, side shops we see in strip malls and things like that and gas stations. Is, look, we are selling these legally. We are checking IDs. We're not selling to young kids, yet you're punishing us. Now all you're doing is you're going to drive these flavors to the streets, and these kids are going to find these flavors elsewhere, and they may not be safe. So that's the argument, is you're creating this new market, though, to be honest with you, these kids were probably getting it from that market anyway. So are you just making that market larger,
stronger,
yes,
even
exactly.
more profitable? Because those Wisconsin brothers, I guess 20 and 23 were their ages, they're now in Kenosha County Jail facing charges with distributing and manufacturing because they were using THC, mm-hmm. which is illegal still in Wisconsin.
And huge amounts.
And they were, you know, just all kinds of those crazy flavors that you were talking about before that appeal to kids, the watermelons, the strawberries and cream and all this kind of stuff. A lot of kids just thought this is kind of fun until they started tracing back to these brothers so many of these illnesses, and the kids who were getting sick.
Yeah.
You wonder what percentage of it, you know, actually came from those black market type of, or the THC laced ones, the pods, and not the sort of official Juul ones.
That's what the CDC and FDA are trying to still investigate. I mean, they think they've got a pretty good understanding of kind of where, what brands made people sick, but where they came from is still a big question.
Because that's still, overall, it is a question, isn't it? About when they look at the who got sick and how many of them, it felt as if some of them were linked to that vitamin E that was added, the added. Some of them were linked to the THC, but then they said there were some that came from the more traditional brands too, which made it sort of a question mark that you can't yet at least conclusively say, oh, it's just this or oh, it's just that. They don't seem to really know conclusively.
We learned a lot in that 6-month period because people were getting sick in the fall and they just didn't know what it was. They just seemed like some kind of lung illness, and it took a while for the CDC and other health agencies to put the pieces together and realize what it was that was making people sick, like the common thread.
Mm-hmm. So now they just say that we're going to temporarily take a look at things, and that's where we are now.
Yep. I mean, I don't think it's the end of e-cigarettes. I'm sure you know, the business models are getting figured out right now. Obviously, the goal is to get these flavors back out onto the shelves, especially for those who own vape shops. But we'll see how long that process takes.
Yeah, it's just it's like you in the process of trying to do something really, really good, you just hope that it doesn't, you know, drive it to the black market, that this doesn't have or the reverse effect and that kind of thing. And I guess that's what they've got to determine. You know, it's sort of trying to do the right thing and ending up, I don't know. you know?
You don't want to take people's rights away, but on the other hand, too, you don't need a generation of kids getting sick,
yeah.
Especially if we're talking 25% of high schoolers right now, right?
25%, big number. All right, Ryan Burrow, thank you so much for that. Right. We appreciate it. And then the Bernie, we is not officially winning Iowa. Right?
We will wait for 100% and then the re-canvas, and then I don't know, maybe by July we'll have the numbers.
Maybe by then. Oh my gosh. All right. Well, we've got more coming up here on WGN Radio. Thank you, Ryan. Ryan Burrow of WGN Radio, ABC Radio fame. Will the new Naperville rules about dog sales shut down pet stores that sell dogs? It's one of the strongest local policies, local pieces of legislation on the books to halt commercially bred dogs from being sold there. What's it all about? Would you buy a dog? Have you bought a dog or a puppy at a pet store? And did it work out okay for you? Did your dog have medical problems? Did you ever find out where that dog came from? Was it a commercial breeding kind of place? That's the question. They're saying that that's where all the problems come from. We do have a guest coming up on the show. She would like to see more of these laws on the book. She is an advocate. She does some work with PAWS and the Humane Society and a number of other things. But she is going to join us to tell us about whether or not that is a good idea or to make these laws stronger. And what's wrong with the Chicago law, too? Because the Chicago law is the one that is, we thought we had a ban here on commercially bred dogs coming into our pet stores. But when you take a closer look at what we're doing here in Chicago, it's really not that strong. There are a number of loopholes. We were just talking with Ryan Burrow about loopholes, but a number of loopholes in that particular law here in Chicago. So we need to mention that. And then we also have in trending topics, did you see Gayle King lashing out at her own network at CBS for how they turned her interview into salacious clickbait? She interviewed Lisa Leslie of the WNBA about Kobe Bryant. She asked Lisa about Kobe's history with women, both with coaching young women in basketball, but also with the rape allegation that came up. Gayle King says the whole thing was taken out of context, that when CBS finally posted it on their site, that it didn't quite come out the way it should have. And so she is very publicly talking about her own network. But I got to get to this before we move on here on WGN Radio and get to the bottom of the hour news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. You've heard the saying, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, does it really make a sound? Well, if it's snowing in Chicago and a local TV reporter doesn't go out and report on it, did it really happen? That was the subject this morning. It made me laugh when I was watching Channel 9 this morning because Nancy Liu, WGN TV reporter, you know her, she was out there in the snow. They put the reporter out there. We know that that's what's happened. I've been in that situation myself as a local TV reporter. But Nancy had this awesome kind of take and this great exchange with the anchors on Channel 9 this morning. We have a little clip of that.
One of those mornings, and Paul and Robin, Larry and Robin, heading back to you. I have to point out that I think that people in our newsroom think that people at home are not going to believe that it snowed until they see me out in the snow. So here it is. Here it is, people.
Yeah.
It really snowed overnight. It happened.
Right, Nancy?
It's here.
She's a liar. She's a little liar, though, so I understand why, you know, people would question her.
I don't know if it's like, it's like, do you not believe Paul?
Right.
Paul said it snowed.
Right.
This is where you're supposed to pick it up and show us the consistency of that snow.
Yeah.
Didn't you go to local news 101?
This is a public service, kids.
Yes.
Yeah.
For the kids, it's not a good packing snow.
Nancy's like, if I do one more
public
of these
service.
Live shots.
So they went back and forth and back and forth. Nancy just kind of making fun of the fact that she's out in the snow, and she did a very nice job reporting on the snow. Coming up here on the show, not the snow, but the show, the Naperville new rules that are coming about those dog sales. Do you think it's the right idea? Have you purchased a dog yourself at a pet store? Did you have any problems? That's what they're saying, what they're saying about why some changes needed to be made and why our next guest would like to see more changes made throughout the entire region. We'll hear what you think. Let us know. 312-981-7200. There's much more coming up here on WGN Radio. All right, Anna DeVlantis here, Skyline Studios, along with Denise Bocek. She has done a lot of work with animal legislation, animal welfare issues, and she works with PAWS and the Humane Society on a number of different issues. We were talking about this Naperville ban on commercially bred animals. They don't allow them to sell them in pet stores. And Denise, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess just explain to us very basically, what is a commercially bred dog and how do you classify that?
So otherwise known as a puppy mill is a breeding, commercial breeding operation with anywhere from 10 to 1,000 breeding dogs where profit is placed above the animal's well-being. These animals can live in stacked cages without adequate access to food and water. They don't receive regular vet care. So the conditions are deplorable, and they're basically these animals are mass produced, and the breeding animals rarely get a break between each breeding cycle.
Right. So I think most of us have seen those videos and the investigations to bust these puppy mills with the horrible conditions and the bad, you know, the bad treatment of these animals, and nobody likes to see that. Are there other commercially bred dogs that would be treated okay? I mean, is this going too far? I guess is a question. Would there be others who are doing the right thing by their animals, or is that really the small percentage of the case?
So I think the issue is a little bit deeper than that, right? Mm-hmm. Because the Animal Welfare Act and the USDA minimum care standards are inadequate, and the standards just have to be increased, improved, actually. There are hobby breeders, which are breeders that have less than 5 breeding dogs, and those are actually not included.
They're not.
In typical pet store ordinances. I know the one in Buffalo Grove bans pet stores completely.
Oh.
So there's different, you know, there's different variations of ordinances and
so
what
no
their
pet
requirements
stores
are
allowed in Buffalo Grove. So that
Correct.
Would be the strongest one I've heard of. Are there others that are, I mean, that
no,
seems pretty strong.
I think that's the strongest. I think the problem is that, you know, the USDA website, which was really the primary source for licensing and inspection data, mm-hmm. A lot of that data in February of 2017 was removed. So that eliminates the transparency into these breeding facilities and the commercial operations and eliminates really the public's ability to make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm. So then when Naperville banned this yesterday, I think the word came out, was expected that this was going to happen? Was this a tough fight to bring this to?
I believe the HSUS was spearheading that effort, and I believe they've been working on it for a while, maybe even a year or plus.
Mm-hmm. And so they, Buffalo Grove, you did work on yourself.
I led that ordinance.
Yeah. So what kind of a pushback did you get when you were going through that process? I think I talked to you earlier. You said it was a pretty lengthy process. These things don't happen overnight, but you had to convince lawmakers there and the population, the public, to get on your side and say, hey, well, we really shouldn't be selling these dogs here. What did you hear?
So I think Buffalo Grove is a very well-educated community, and the lawmakers, the city council members, wanted to make sure they understood all the facts. The challenge is that there's a lot of information out there, and pet store groups and lobbyists have a lot of opinions that may skew the way that you view things, right? So it took a lot of time to sort of dissect what their concerns were, some of which were, why do we want to restrict businesses? And, you know, my response to that is, if we don't have, you know, if we didn't want to restrict business at all, we wouldn't have zoning ordinances which dictate which businesses can go in which areas, how big they are, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so it's fascinating, too, because I was talking to Paula Faseas at the head of PAWS about this, just sort of researching and looking at this issue a little bit. And I said, well, I keep reading about how Chicago has an ordinance like this that bans the sale of commercially bred dogs here. But I'm like, well, that doesn't make too much sense because I see pet stores all the time, and I don't know where they're getting their dogs, but I assume they're commercial breeders. And she said, well, that's because the law here was passed
and there were so many loopholes in it that it's pretty meaningless. She said, if you call yourself an official animal care center and you become 501(c) status, charity status, then you can then go ahead and sell the pets, and it's okay. So what you ended up happening, what ended up happening after they passed this legislation was that suddenly some pet stores decided they were 501(c)s and they were animal shelters or whatever it is you have to be and become in order to get that sort of status. They did it, and so they continued operating under that particular banner, doing the same kind of thing. So it doesn't feel as if the one we passed here in Chicago really made any kind of a difference.
You're right. There is a loophole in the ordinance, and definitions are important, right, when you're looking at ordinances. And you're right. The rescue group is defined as a 501(c)(3). I think the intent was that you can have pet stores. So understand that not all ordinances ban pet stores completely. The idea is that, you know, you can still have services, vet care, grooming. You can still sell reptiles and fish. You can also offer animals that come from animal control facilities and humane societies and shelters for adoption. So what the loophole in the City of Chicago ordinance did was allow, you know, the pet store group to actually continue to sell puppy mill dogs.
So from your research, was it after you obviously looked at the different puppy mills conditions, and you've already spoken about how those can be horrific and terrible for the dogs, and none of us like that situation, and no one would probably want to support buying a dog if they thought, oh, I understood exactly what was going on there in those horrible conditions. But are there other situations where private breeders are going to be okay? Can they still do it? Does this affect them at all? If you're just like somebody who is really caring about the breed and you are, you know, you want to keep selling the dogs and, you know, continue breeding them, is that okay?
So I think, again, it depends on the ordinance, but, you know, your typical hobby breeder, which is a breeder that has less than 5 breeding dogs, their intent or their purpose is actually for the betterment of the breed. So reputable hobby breeders would actually pair the female and male dog to get desired characteristics. They don't live in the conditions that puppy mills live in. So it's, again, for the betterment of the breed. So, you know, I think it comes down to research, right? So, you know, if you believe you want to go to a hobby breeder, go to the facility, see where the animals grow up, see the conditions, meet the mother and father dog, check out the vet records, ask for vet records, and, you know, do your diligence.
Yeah. What have you seen with the animals that come from the puppy mills ultimately? Have you seen that they're sicker or they require a lot more help? Or what do you find when you actually look at those animals that were adopted from those conditions?
So I my knowledge comes from people that I've spoken to, and I know that my local representative, Jonathan Carroll, he actually purchased a dog from a pet store that was in Buffalo Grove at the time. Shortly thereafter, the dog became sick and ultimately had to be euthanized. So in a lot of cases, people that buy puppies from pet stores that initiate or come from puppy mills, they become sick, they have behavioral issues, and it becomes very expensive for the owners or the purchasers, the consumers, to take care of.
Yeah.
And they end up in animal welfare or animal shelters and humane societies.
Do you see that them going to like paws and places like that because they've become too expensive to take care of?
Exactly. And so that becomes the rescue groups and the shelters' responsibility to take care of. I mean, one important statistic to note is that I think something like 6.5 million cats and dogs end up in shelters on an annual basis, of which 710, I think, are returned back to their owners, and 3.2 million are adopted out. 2.7 of that total. I know I'm giving you a lot of statistics.
There's a lot of statistics.
I know, sorry. 2.7 million are euthanized in shelters each year.
That's a big number. I mean, that's a very 2.7 million are euthanized.
Correct.
That's nationwide.
Correct.
Because they can't find homes. So yes, there are a lot of good dogs to find in shelters. Here's 815. This speaks to your earlier point. Unfortunately, if you adopt a dog that is supposedly a rescue, it is a donation, not a sale, no matter what type of mess it turns out to be. Is that true?
That is true.
Mm-hmm. And then we also have someone who's saying that I had a great experience because I got my boxer from Purebred Breeders. She was shipped here from Florida on an animal flight, picked her up at O'Hare in the cargo, and she was clean and smelled like baby powder. Great experience. So there are legitimate breeders out there who are very good at taking care of dogs and really just want to keep the breed going, and they adhere to all the American Kennel Club standards and things like that, and
sure,
you can have a good experience.
Absolutely.
That way.
Sure.
So you would say go to a shelter, but if not, go to a professional breeder, really check them out, learn about where the animals are from.
So I would say also that you have a couple other options. Shelters do have purebred dogs. There are also breed-specific rescues that carry each individual breed. So do your research, but there are definitely options.
Yeah, that's right. I've seen them. They have the different breeds have certain shelters that take care of them. So that's a pretty cool option, too. And there are a number of them in this area, right?
Absolutely.
We have some of them. 847, where are the puppy mills located? Why can't they be shut down? Now, we see investigations about these horrible conditions and charges often brought against the operators. Why can't more of them be shut down so you eliminate that supply part of it all?
So there's a couple of issues. One is that there are only, I think, 119 USDA inspectors across the country, and they have to inspect about 8,000 facilities that are regulated. So that's one of the challenges. The other challenge is, I think the estimates say that there's about 10,000 puppy mills, of which only 2,300 are USDA licensed. So they operate in wooded areas and areas that they really can't be found.
Kind of off the radar kind
Correct.
Of thing, where
yeah.
they don't want to be found, I would imagine,
Correct.
Considering things. Well, Denise, that answers a lot of our questions, and I really appreciate you taking time to come on in the studio here and talk about it. Do you imagine we'll see more ordinances like this passed?
I do. Right now, there's 343 across the country.
Gee.
Two states have puppy mill bans as well.
How many communities around here?
Illinois has 14.
14 different communities. Okay, well, keep us posted on things, and then thanks for explaining stuff to us. We appreciate it. Denise Bocek is her name. She was instrumental in the Buffalo Grove legislation and has worked with PAWS and the Humane Society on other issues.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Good seeing you. Coming up, will a Chicago area woman become a saint? There's a movement to canonize her. Dorothy Day is her name. She died years ago, but her legacy lives on. The Pope even mentioned her recently. Should she become a saint? The controversial figure is the subject of a new documentary. They're talking about it tonight because there's a premiere here in Chicago, the Chicago premiere, and the director is joining us, the filmmaker, coming up here on WGN Radio. All right, this is a fascinating subject here. I just saw this and I thought, wow, we got to see if I can get the filmmaker here in studio. He is here in studio. His name is Martin Doblmeyer. Thank you for being here, Martin.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
It's a fascinating subject you're bringing up here. And I know there's been this movement, I think it's fair to say, this woman who isn't actually born in Chicago, but who spent her early years here in Chicago. Her name's Dorothy Day, and that people would like to see her become a saint. How about that?
Well, she's on track to become a saint. There's three categories to become a saint, and she's already passed the first category. So she's in the second grouping, and a lot of people are working hard to make that happen.
Right. So what's next to make that happen?
Well, the Catholic Church is very careful about who it anoints as a saint. It just mm-hmm. is. And so it can take anywhere. I just gave a talk the other day up at in St. Norbert's in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And St. Norbert died in 1100. He wasn't canonized until 1500.
It took a long time.
400 years to make him a saint. But now Dorothy Day is kind of being fast-tracked. So she died in 1980. This first step happened in 2000. So that was a gap of 20 years. And now they're hoping that phase two will end in the next couple of years. So that might be, 2022, 2024, something like that. And that actually would be pretty quick. And the second step really is the collecting of all the archival material mm-hmm. related to Dorothy Day, everything she ever wrote, whether it, not just her books, but her letters and memoirs, all the communications, and there's volumes of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to interview everybody who knew Dorothy Day and is still alive, compile all this information, and then literally bring it to the Vatican and have it checked out. And I think it has to all be translated into Latin as well. And then once that happens, they're going to be looking for a miracle. There have to be two miracles to get you through the process of final canonization.
Right.
It used to be three, and now it's two. And if they can actually have evidence of one miracle, then she'll become blessed, venerable. in the Catholic Church. And the third step, if they can find one more miracle, the second one, she becomes canonized, St. Dorothy.
So you've been doing this film, and you've been digging up some of that archival footage, and there's film of her also.
There is. Not all that much. So yeah. It's a public television film, public television style. So we use actual recordings of her voice and photographs and a handful of images that we were able to come up with from films that we were able to discover. One of them in Ireland. There was a really wonderful interview that she did in the mid-1970s in Ireland that's very helpful for us in the film. But there's not all that much, but we were able to actually find the way to make the film. And we released the film on DVD a couple of weeks ago. It hit number one on Amazon for as a documentary film. And now I'm doing a number of events all across the country to get the word out. And the film will start airing on public television March 6th as a special for the month of March for Women's History Month.
And what's it called?
The name of the film is called Revolution of the Heart, The Dorothy Day Story.
You've done the research. Did you find evidence of miracles? That is the third phase here.
I didn't. It wasn't really what I was looking for.
Do you think they'll find it?
I think they probably will. I mean, they're looking for people who would, typically that would claim a miraculous healing of some kind. That's usually the one that gets everything through. The fact that she did all that she did in her life, and then the newspaper that she created in 1933 is still in publication, and the houses that she began in 1933 in the midst of the Depression to feed the hungry and take care of the homeless, they're still going. Mm. When she died in 1980, there were 30 homes. Today, there are almost 250 homes nationwide, and to me, that's its own form of miracle. So they may or may not be able to come up with the evidence of healings, which is generally what they tend to look for, but I think there's other reasons to think of Dorothy Day as a saint.
A true advocate for working people, helping people who are poor and down in their luck in this world, that's what she devoted her life's work to?
Yes, she did. I mean, and she did it instinctively, Anna. What she did was, in 1933, in the heart of the Depression, she looked around and saw that, there were millions and millions of people unemployed, hungry, and she literally just went out and opened up a place and got this whole program started as one house, and then it grew to a second house. And there was points during the course of her own life that she was literally feeding thousands at different points across the country. So it's just, it's one person responding to the immediate need that she saw in front of her. So she wasn't an institutional person. She didn't tell you, go off and see if you can get social security and welfare and everything. That was not her style. Her style was, if you came in and you needed a meal, you got one.
Mm. I saw an interesting quote in some of the background of her and things that were said about her. The Washington Post did an awfully nice article about her. If someone wants to look up in detail a little more about her and also watch, of course, the show, and then we'll be talking more about where you can find that. But the quote says, when many people think of saints, they think of people who are kind of removed from the world in some sacred way. But she showed there can be a holiness of action, of engagement, of the challenges of our time, meaning she engaged with people one-on-one and really was among the people.
That was her whole life. In fact, she would even chastise people who... there's a chapter in the film where these wonderful nuns talked about how embarrassed they were because their job was to get up in the morning, go off in Los Angeles and take care of the hungry and the homeless and the poor and everybody else. They came home at night and lived in the convent. And they had, as a guest one time, Dorothy Day. And Dorothy Day says to them, well, why do you come home at night? Why don't you live with the people that you're taking care of? And they felt embarrassed. The community that was doing all this good work felt embarrassed by Dorothy Day coming into their house and telling them, you're not doing it the right way. You're supposed to be living with the people that you care for. It's the only way that you can do it properly. And that's what she believed.
Our guest is filmmaker Martin Doblmeier. Revolution of the Heart, The Dorothy Day Story, is going to start airing on PBS in March. Interesting, she's described as both a typical grandmother and a self-described anarchist. She was controversial. She was anti-establishment in a lot of ways. Would you say that's fair, or how would you characterize her?
I think she was clearly all of that, and that's what makes for a good film, isn't it? I mean, ultimately,
yeah, right.
That's what makes for a good film. I mean, she is a grandmother to nine. If you look at the images, she looks like a typical grandmother, and yet at the same time, she would take care of the grandchildren, then she would go off and get arrested because she was protesting the idea of nuclear weapons being financed by our federal government, where that money should have instead be going to taking care of the poor and the needy in the country. She was absolutely adamant about that, the disproportionate amount of money that was being spent. And so she wound up on the FBI watch list. His grandmother what? On the FBI watch list as a dangerous radical person in America, someone to be watched. J. Edgar Hoover had her on the list and actually considered her for sedition, because she would actually write in the newspapers that we can't be supporting these war efforts. And she's one, this is a very challenging part of it. She was one of the first people that come out against the Second World War. And if there was anything that you would call a just war, it was probably the Second World War. And she got a lot of grief for that. She believed fundamentally in the pacifist idea that she believed that the gospel called you to be a peacemaker, and that participating in a war, even the Second World War, was wrong. And so she lost half the people in her community. She lost half the funding that she was receiving. She really took it on the chin as a result of that stand, but she never wavered.
Yeah, it says that Pope Francis talked about her and mentioned her in a speech recently, which also makes you understand the considerations that are underway for sainthood, that she's certainly someone who, just not that many years after her death, is really under consideration and moving through the process.
Yeah, Pope Francis came and spoke. He was the first pope ever to speak to a joint session of Congress, 2015. And he based his whole speech really on four characters that he felt as though created the American character. Now think about this. When he doesn't mention George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, he mentions four characters that to him really helped shape the values of America. Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, Thomas Merton, the monk, the monastic priest, Thomas Merton, and Dorothy Day, who was on the FBI watch list and considered for sedition. And here he is raising up her story. And there were, I know Senator Tim Kaine, because I'm in Virginia, and Tim Kaine was in the audience, and we interviewed him for the film, and he said that a lot of his other fellow senators came up to him afterwards and said, "Well, why is the Pope talking about Doris Day?" And he said, no, it's Dorothy. It's Dorothy Day. So there was a great deal of interest. And, of course, in some ways, that's its own form of imprimatur, where somebody, you know, like the Pope says, look, I'm going to be certainly looking at her for canonization. Yep. So there's hope that this is going to move forward.
University of Illinois grad. How about that? Back in her day.
Yeah, she was here for a number of years, studied, and that's where she got her real, part of where she got her real hunger for literature and writing. She was reading Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and people like that. And it's all... that's all sort of giving to her a sense of global perspective.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, and I'm so glad you came in to talk to us. There is a screening tonight at Loyola University, and you are the filmmaker, Martin Doblmeyer, but people can catch this on PBS coming up in March, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
March, the date again is March.
Well, the initial release date is March 6th, but it'll be airing for several years on public television stations around the country.
You can find it. That's right. And it's called Revolution of the Heart, the Dorothy Day story. Martin, thanks for sharing it with us. Appreciate
it. A pleasure. Thank you.
We have much more coming up here on WGN Radio, including the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom at the top of the hour. It's me, Anna D, 204 here on WGN Radio. It's our Family Matters segment, and here with us, he's John Duffy, clinical psychologist, certified life coach, parenting relationship expert. He's the author of Parenting the New Teen in the Age of Anxiety. Get that book. She is Heidi Stevens, Tribune columnist and Firestarter. Her column got this enormous response. I was looking at my Twitter feed and my social media. I'm like, oh my gosh, everybody's responding to your column about the halftime performance. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, no, that one did start a fire. Yeah.
It did. And, you know, the issue, it brought in so many things that are kind of worthy of talking about, because it's J-Lo and Shakira. Okay, halftime show. And people thought it was either empowering, or they thought there was something that about the Me Too movement that didn't fit with this sort of performance on stage. And you directly address that in the column.
Yeah. So a lot of the email that I was getting the next day was sort of, you know, where are you on this? You know, you've been this voice for empowering women and calling for women to be seen as more than just sex objects. And where are you on this halftime show?
Right.
And I didn't see that coming. I didn't see a 15-minute performance during the Super Bowl, which has always been a place of sort of spectacle and a little bit of sex. If you look at like the Carl's Jr. commercials and the GoDaddy commercials, and how
you go back to Cindy Crawford and her Pepsi commercials, that was super sexy and
I've always sort of thought that was a little piece of the Super Bowl. So I didn't I wasn't expecting the backlash, and then I wasn't expecting it to be held up as some sort of statement about where we are as a gender and whether we can still take women seriously when they pull a show like that.
Before
out of
we
their
get to
hats.
That piece, because that's what we want to talk about. That was the substance of what you had to say. Some of the criticism, the backlash, as you put it, Heidi, is have the courage, Heidi, to say it was exploitation and in poor taste, especially when many families are watching with kids.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people really responded to the fact that, you know, they put on the show while kids were watching. Now, I watched it with my kids. You know, I of course, every family gets to choose what feels appropriate or inappropriate for their children to see. For me, it felt like, well, we're talking about that on the way home. you know, they might have questions.
I was sitting there praying no one would ask anything. I was like, please don't.
It didn't feel, but again, it didn't feel so super different from when we go to Bulls games and watch the Lovables, or when we toured AT&T Stadium as a family because my son loves the Dallas Cowboys. And, you know, they take you in the Cowboys cheerleaders locker room and there's life-size pictures of every one of the cheerleaders. Like, it just it just didn't feel way out of left field to me.
Right. I will say, I mean, we looked around, we had a lot of parents with young children at our Super Bowl party, a lot of kids' parents from the school and that kind of thing, and probably 15 kids that were like first, second, and third grader type ages. And the parents were, we were all glued to it. I mean, I will say it was hard to look away. But if I took a video of their responses, I will say some people looked a little shocked. They did. I'm not going to lie about that. People looked like, okay, whoa.
Yeah,
because it was overtly sexual.
Right.
Yeah. And she was pointing to, you know, different things and they were zooming in on all kinds of things. It was hard to look anywhere else. And that's what it was about.
Yeah.
Right. So, but your point is that when Adam Levine went around shaking his thing, no one said it was all about men.
Well, yeah. So my Adam Levine thing, you know, it's not that he didn't get any flack for that or that everyone embraced that
because
performance. Yeah, people, but it wasn't held up as some sort of standard for now. Can we take men seriously after that performance? You know, what sort of contradiction are we having to put up with here, where men want to be sexy on one hand and then taken seriously on the other? We didn't do that with his performance in the way that we're doing it with Shakira and J-Lo's performance. And that's the part that is hard for me to get my head around, why this performance is supposed to stand for something larger than what it was, which was a 15-minute halftime performance. I don't think it needs to say whether women should or shouldn't be viewed as sex objects, whether we can or can't take women seriously, whether the Me Too movement, you know, has failed. I think it was a Super Bowl halftime performance.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't cancel out all of that. Dr. John, from you look at these from a clinical perspective. Yeah. What do you think when you hear all this?
I actually agree completely with Heidi. I think some of the comments that you received, Heidi, had a lot to do with men who I think were affected and feel kind of disempowered somehow by the Me Too movement. And so there's this seething anger. And I see this in men sometimes that kind of shows up at times like this. I don't know that there's real sound reasoning behind it, but I think that's part of what we're looking at here. But by and large, you know, having watched it myself, I don't disagree, Anna. I think it was intended to be provocative at times. I just don't think that that's necessarily a comment on the gender of men or women in any way. I think it's kind of silly if men can't watch women being sexy and sexual that they can't control themselves somehow around other women. You know, there's something kind of ridiculous about that. And I did have a mom in my office last night saying, what's interesting to me about this is we're talking about what men's reactions are when in fact, we kind of, as some of us thought this was for us. Like, we thought, like, this was like, I'm a 50-year-old woman. I feel pretty empowered by the fact that J-Lo can get on a stripper pole. Uh-huh. And that feels pretty good to me.
Yeah, like, how did she do that?
Right.
There's a little envy and jealousy maybe in a couple households. And then I heard we had one listener who told us, my husband was glued to the TV. I couldn't get him to look away. We have 773 right now saying it was a strip club show. I mean, people did have that kind of reaction to it, but your point is that, like, if you, just because two women headline a performance and they're entertainers, that doesn't mean you can't take women seriously. That's a fair point.
Yeah, that was the reaction that I just couldn't get behind. The idea that because of this performance, now they've set women back, or they've made it harder for women to be taken seriously, or now, you know, on the one hand you're saying don't view women as sex objects, and on the other hand J-Lo and Shakira come out and do this performance. Now what? It's like, well, now what? I don't know how that would I mean, what if a woman's just an astronaut or a teacher or an author? I mean, does J-Lo's performance somehow affect your ability to take her seriously in her role? You know, in
yeah.
another woman seriously
I
in her role?
I partially blame the camera people on this one because I felt like they zoomed in so tight on everything. It was like there was nowhere else you could look, right?
Yeah.
It was right there in front of you. And it's sort of like, it's there, but I guess you have the option to look away.
You could go get chips in the kitchen or turn it off.
Right, exactly. This is at 630 Super Bowl halftime show. Workplace sexual harassment are two entirely different things. One you can watch if you want the other, and you shouldn't have to put up with it at all.
Yeah.
I think they're agreeing with
sure.
you there.
I agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of reaction did you hear? I mean, were you responding to all of it? What were you doing?
Oh, my God.
Because it had to be nuts for you for 48 hours after the Super Bowl.
People are really angry right now. I don't know. My inbox has been more colorful than usual this week. A lot of people just feel like this is a hypocritical moment for women, that, you know, I'm hearing a lot of like, you want your cake and eat it too, right? Like, you want to support these two women in a slut show. A lot of people are calling it slut show in my inbox. You want to support these two women in their slut show, and then you also want to like condemn Harvey Weinstein. Like, which is it? And it's like, well, both. But I'm hearing a lot of people say that it can't be both.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the puzzling part. If you think that they're, let us know. Let us know. 312-981-7200, your thoughts. How was halftime different from girls in bikinis? Cheerleaders, Dancing with the Stars, we've seen their outfits. Are people jealous much? I think so. You do see, I mean, the sexy outfits and the sexy dancing, it's there. It's everywhere on regular broadcast TV
sure.
all the time at all hours of the day, daytime television even. You can see more than what you want to see. Many of the people screaming the loudest about the fact that this was not family-friendly also allow their kids to play video games where they steal cars and shoot people.
Right. And watch Netflix in their rooms with the door closed, having no idea what's, you know, what's on that show. You know, like,
yeah.
that happens all the time.
So
sure.
as a parent, what do you say to kids who were exposed to all this stuff? Do you just sit them down and say, hey, this is it? What do you say?
I say that, you know, parents are entitled to have their rules about what kids can watch and what they can't. But with something like this, I think this is kind of not the worst stimulus for parents to talk to their kids. Like, you know, let's watch the show. What do you think of it? Depending on the age, you know, mm-hmm. and that, of course, there's an age under which that's not appropriate. But for a lot of kids, they'll have thoughts about this and they're not that uncomfortable sharing them. I've been talking to kids all week about the halftime show and they're really kind of really interesting to listen to.
What kinds of questions do they ask? Like,
kids are actually way
about?
More open-minded about this than a lot of the adults are, because a lot of the kids are kind of like, oh, I thought it was really cool. And I thought it was, a lot of kids were focused not on the sexual component, but on the cultural component that gets missed a lot of the time, because a lot of the dancing that is, you know, hip shaking and things like that are also culturally appropriate, you know? So it's kind of two Latina women, you know, kind of demonstrating the nature of their culture as well.
Yeah.
Which,
well, there were some political messages woven in there
yeah.
that I think young people were especially in tune to, right, with
the Puerto Rican flag
and the kids in cages. And
yeah.
Right. There was a lot. There was something for everyone. 773, I'm a 56-year-old woman. I thought they were fabulous. They are established performers and businesswomen in their own right. This is their job, and I love the show. I think it kind of was, you can't say that it shocked in the way that you wouldn't expect an overtly sexual performance from either of them, because that's what they're both known for.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think maybe the stripper pole and some of the really uber tight shots of, you know, them pointing at themselves, sort of that's where we're like, whoa,
yeah.
this is just, you know, this is one step farther than we thought they would go.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, I want to be careful not to sound like I'm condemning anyone who didn't love the show. I think everybody has, of course, the right to react to the show however they want. I just think that, you know, it would be okay to be like, oof, sweetie, I hated that show. I'm actually sorry I had that on while you were in the room or something like
sure.
that. But I'm not clear on why it's a statement about women and whether we can take them seriously anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's the part I'm not.
Yeah.
The Bachelor 847 is more demeaning to women than the halftime show. I might agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
That's
love the Bachelor.
A pretty fair statement, I think.
I guess they have the Bachelorette too, but I don't know.
I'm on the record as hating the Bachelor.
Not really a big fan of the Bachelor.
No. I would like
going back in the day, the Trista
canceled.
And Ryan. Did you watch it back then?
I've watched enough of it to know that I hate it, and That's where I'll leave that.
That's where things sit there. Heidi, don't prompt there. People. Don't start any more fires, Heidi. You're known to do that kind of thing. All right, we have to talk about Barbie and some new changes there. And then also Elizabeth Smart, some new news there that's pretty tough to hear, but it's worthy of discussion for sure. Our guests are Dr. John Duffy and Heidi Stevens from Chicago Tribune, and we're back with more here in a moment here on WGN Radio. Got a number of comments coming in about the halftime and Heidi's column and everything that we were talking about in our last segment. I'm going to go home, 815, and watch the halftime show again. I'm sure my husband will, too. Appreciate it. He was in front of the television on his knees watching this. I heard, yes, that was a common thing that people said. Of course, sex sells. That's what it's about. They're trying to sell albums, another comment. And why can't women be sexy and empowering? Agreeing with you, Heidi. That's another comment from someone. We do have 847. The halftime show was inappropriate, and it is hard to take women seriously after that. If they're talented, why do they have to resort to this type of performance? That was another comment we got. Let's see. What about hula dancers in Hawaii, cheerleaders, and people pointing to other people in the entertainment industry? We see all the time that kind of follows sort of that same kind of way of dancing, right? Should we move on from the halftime thing now? I think we've kind of talked about that.
I think we've kind of...
Yes.
Yeah, we can move on. I'm okay with that.
All right. So there are other things to talk about. And we want to talk about Elizabeth Smart. She's in the news today. Mm-hmm. And this is... It's hard to hear. It's kind of heartbreaking when you think about what she's gone through in her past. Of course, being kidnapped as a child, held in captivity, her story... Well known. Well, today she came out the news and gave an interview about how she was on an airplane and she was sexually assaulted while she was sleeping on the airplane. Mm-hmm. We have a little bit of the audio from that interview she just gave.
I had been asleep and all of a sudden I woke up because I felt someone's hand rubbing in between my legs on my inner thigh.
What did you do?
I was shocked. I mean, the last time someone touched me without my say-so was when I was kidnapped, and I froze. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah, you listen to that. She does. It goes back to takes her back to when she was kidnapped. Mm-hmm. Dr. John, it seems like that's got to be something. I'm sure she's been working through therapy to get over up to begin with. Then something like this happens, really troubling.
Well, and you think about somebody who's been, you know, traumatized, and not just in an incident, but you know, for a very extended period of time when she was really young, and then to be re-traumatized now. You know, I worry about like, okay, so how will that manifest for her? You know, I hope she's getting the help she needs.
Yeah, you do hope that. She has contacted the FBI because it would be pretty obvious to try to find the person. I don't know if there's video or way to prove it, but they're certainly investigating. They know who was sitting there, and they know when she woke up that this happened. I don't know if other people witnessed it or not, but it just brings you, it's so sad that it happens to her again.
Yeah, and it's, you're in a place where you...
Or anybody.
Yeah, of course. And there's an assumed sense of safety because you're surrounded by people and there's flight attendants walking by, you know, every few minutes or so. And so, it's perfectly natural to think you can fall asleep and not be in any danger. So that's just tragic.
Yeah, it is tragic. I like that she's coming out so publicly to talk about it because I'm sure it seems like one of those things where when you do speak about it, it starts being taken seriously that this the kind of thing, you know, isn't okay. I don't know how prevalent it is. I don't hear of these stories that much.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that the FBI gets involved. I wonder if that's because you're in
federal airspace.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting just from a public safety standpoint to know that those are the steps you follow, right? Contact the airline, make sure the airline contacts the FBI, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems I wouldn't have known that either to think of doing that, but she did. And she also runs some self-defense classes for women and girls since her incident, that what happened to her over that long period of time to try to reach out, help other people as well. So good for her for speaking out and good for her for how she's trying to turn her life around and do things for other people in the wake of that horrifying experience.
And it's actually a more common experience than you might think. Women have reported to me being groped in like really, really public spaces like that. And oftentimes the self-defense class on the back end is the empowering thing that they do to just to do something for themselves, to have something they can do just in case this happens again.
I would think maybe some people feel as if there's some kind of protection in public. As a person who might be victimized, you feel as if there is, you know, people around, so it won't happen. And then maybe that kind of inspires people to do it.
Right.
And make it
right.
easier to like say, hey, they won't expect it here. Yeah. I'm on the L, or I'm in a crowded concert space or whatever. And then how do you report it, or what do you
do? Right.
It's like it just happens, right? We're getting more texts on the halftime stuff. Deanna, I voiced my opinion on social media. I don't know if she means your social media, Heidi, but she says on social media, when I admired the athleticism of J-Lo and Shakira, I thought that some of the dancing was overtly sexual, overly so, inappropriate for an all-ages show, especially at a large party where I can't change the channel. The mean responses and harassment that I've received for expressing that opinion, though, have been pretty hurtful.
Yeah.
And repressive of my opinions. I think you've been feeling a little backlash yourself there, Heidi.
Yeah, the anger feels outsized compared to the topic at hand to me.
For sure. Yeah, it's really powerful reactions all around.
I think we're also kidding ourselves about the access children have to stuff now when they're on YouTube all the time and you see all the suggested videos. I mean, my daughter will be watching cartoons on YouTube and the suggested videos are pretty suggestive. Mm-hmm. It's amazing that it's right there, and I wonder if they're seeing more of it than we saw, just because it's naturally easy to access.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, part of my reaction to all the reaction you received, Heidi, was, oh, come on. Like, you know, our kids are seeing an awful lot more that's way more graphic than what we're looking at here. You know, like, even pretty young kids have access to a lot of data that's way more graphic than that.
We're also talking about the reaction to Kobe Bryant and how it's sort of, it's triggered some memories, where I didn't even think of this angle, but you've seen this, people talking about how when they've lost a spouse or lost a child, that it triggers those memories. There's a mom blogger who basically posted an open letter that went viral. It was an open letter to Vanessa Bryant saying, I know kind of how you feel because this happened to me too.
Mm.
And it's it was just kind of helpful to read through it and understand that, you know, the first day isn't even the worst and the second day it gets worse.
Oh,
and going
yeah.
through all of this, sort of the feelings of it, it kind of helped me, made me think as a friend, this might be helpful to reach out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we had a really tragic year at my daughter's school a couple years ago where two dads passed away within a couple weeks of each other. And what was so, I guess, educational to me was when, you know, the school community, you know, rallied around and swooped in to help the two moms, they each wanted and needed very different things. And so it was a really good lesson for me. And like the one mom, you know, we quickly set up this meal plan and carpooling and all the needs. And she went with that. She said yes to that and wanted it. The other mom said, don't bring me a casserole. I don't want people coming to my house with food. Like, wanted a very different way of us showing our support, and we found that way. She wanted grocery store gift cards. She wanted different things, and so it just was such a good reminder to me to like, don't assume that what worked for one friend works for the other. Don't assume that you know how this person's grieving or you know how this person should grieve. Like, just go and ask and be open to their way. Right?
That seems like the right way to go about it.
And don't even assume that anybody is an expert in grieving. So a lot of times people think like, oh, you lost a husband or a wife, so you know what I should do.
Tell me what I should do.
Yeah. Instead of like, you know, let's work this through together a little bit, because I really don't know what to do either. And I'm in the middle of the loss as well.
Right.
You know?
How would it feel to you if I brought dinner? Ugh, gross. Okay. How would it feel to you if I brought you a Grubhub gift card? Better. You know what I mean?
Kind of like, meet them where they are.
Give them some, right. Mm. Yeah. Brainstorm a little.
And say something. You know, that's one thing I hear consistently from families who are enduring loss is, you know, like, too many people like cross the street when I'm coming close.
Because they're afraid. So they don't know how to deal with
exactly.
it.
Right.
That's so helpful. That is. Guys, thank you. Good seeing you. Dr. John Duffy, he's a clinical psychologist. They're both the host of On Purpose, the Heidi Stevens and Dr. John Duffy podcast. Check that out. And, of course, she's Heidi Stevens, Tribune columnist. You know where to find her. Thanks, guys. Good seeing you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anna.
More to come here on WGN Radio. We have trending topics coming up. Do you see what Gayle King has to say about her own employer? She's lashing out at CBS. She doesn't like what they did to her interview. And we have some Chicago parents who are here to talk about how they're turning tragedy in their lives into helping others as well. Anna DeVlantis here in the Skyline Studios here on WGN. It's 2:32. Trending topics will complete our show at 2:45. Then we'll go to Ro Khan and check in with him. But right now, I have a special guest here with me, someone who is doing God's work in a lot of ways. She's trying to help other parents and build what happened to her, the heartbreak, her pain, and pain her own family dealt with after their son committed suicide. And you decided, Carol Dealey, that you were going to found an organization to try to help other parents to understand bullying, to understand warning signs, and when things can really be bad for a kid that I guess are often overlooked, right? Isn't that what you are trying to tell people?
Yes, thank you for having me. The organization is Gabriel's Light that we founded, and we are sharing our tragic learnings in the death of our son, and things that we didn't know before and things we didn't know immediately after. And so we are bringing to people's attention and to schools' attention, parents, the importance of technology monitoring with keyword search alerts.
So you basically are, let's back up a little bit, because so your son was 12 and was being bullied, and there were some warning signs, but not everything was discovered.
Well, he was 12, our son. He was a happy, well-adjusted, seemingly, boy, involved in extracurricular activities, lots of friends, good grades. When we found out that he had died, and we thought it was an accident. Mm-hmm. So we did not know that there was any bullying going on. We did not know that the iPad at school wasn't being monitored. We did not know that he had given verbal and drew signs of suicide to peers at school.
Right. So you're saying that the computers they use, and most kids do now in schools, that he was using a computer, and that there were some warning signs there, that if the kinds of programs you're trying to put place in schools now might maybe catch things sooner, so that it doesn't escalate in this way, or certainly at least it's taken seriously earlier.
Yes.
Sooner.
Exactly. So many schools have one-to-one technology. That means each child has their own device, or it's signed off to them. Our son did. It never left the school. The schools are mandated to have firewalls, which are supposed to keep adult content or inappropriate content from the devices in the school. So
right.
That's mandated in the year 2000.
Long time ago.
Yeah. Kids know how to circumvent the firewalls, and they have known how to do that for a long time. What in 2015, a company named Bark Technologies introduced keyword search alerts. So if a child is searching guns, drugs, alcohol, depression, suicidal thoughts, an alert will be sent to the school and to the parent.
Is the technology's been there for years, it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Is it expensive? Is there a reason why schools might not all have that already?
It is free for schools, and it is at the most $9 a month for parents for the whole family.
Mm.
I did not know about Bark. Prior to my son's death, another of my children's schools recommended it to me. So why schools don't have it? There's a variety of reasons. If the devices are going home, then there's the privacy issue of families at home.
They don't want it being monitored?
Well, potentially. You don't know who's going to use the device at
mm-hmm.
home.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there's, you know, it takes some work to manage the alerts. And I've heard a school say, well, we don't put suicide on our alerts because if there's somebody searching, kids are searching suicide for a written paper, we won't have the time to answer all those alerts. My response was, well, if you don't have time to manage that, what time do you have? What do you have alerts for, and what time do you have to manage things? Because if it could be, there's many things actually on the internet right now that appear very innocent, dark memes, dark, you know, on YouTube. I think you were mentioning that
things
a little bit ago.
Things get disguised, or they seem to...
Exactly.
Well, I think the troubling part for me is that I will be in the room when my daughter's on YouTube or whatever it is, and she's watching cartoons, or she's watching her princess things, or she's watching things that totally seem appropriate, and then the suggested content will come up that maybe is princess-related, but it's totally inappropriate. And so it feels as if it's...
Exactly.
You constantly have to monitor.
Well, you
things.
Need to turn off the... That's a feature of YouTube, and you can turn that off so it doesn't give you any suggestions. Because I learned that. Yeah.
I'm going to learn that after talking with you. But is bark something else you can get just as a household, somebody listening right now can say, hey, maybe
parents
I'll get that.
It. It's Bark Technologies. It's an app, and the parent manages it, and then they put it on their children's devices. You can discuss it with your child when you're doing it. You don't have to look at everything. As a matter of fact, you know, you want your child to have some degree of privacy, but you will get alerts for anything that's dangerous. And then they give you suggestions on how to have the conversation with your child.
That's important. So you can put any words you want it to.
You can
right?
put anything. There's all different categories. And it really became popular after the Parkland High School shooting mm-hmm. when you can predict violence. You can predict, you know, suicide. So suicidal thoughts are one of the most highest alerts that they follow up with. And what's also interesting is if they see something very, very serious and the parent hasn't reviewed it, they follow up with the parent and say, did you see this alert that we sent you?
So the folks that work at BARC or this, mm-hmm. these organizations that do this will mm-hmm. then follow up with the parent and say, hey, this mm-hmm. looks troubling. You might want to check this out. Have a conversation with your kid. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's harmless. Maybe it's not. That
yes.
seems like a pretty powerful tool.
It is. It is because if you look at a search report, like we received a search report from my son's device, many things on there looked very innocent. But if you click on them, you can see some of them were very dark memes, very dark YouTube, YouTubers they're called.
Right.
Very dark things. And something such as Kermit the Frog. There's a whole collection of Kermit suicide.
Hmm.
And it's different ways that Kermit the Frog has.
And they're not obviously officially sanctioned by Kermit. They're totally dark videos that would be troubling.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you did monitor his activities at mm-hmm. home, and you were doing that kind of thing. It seems as if at the school they weren't. And so you wanted to try to create this program, Gabriel's Light, where mm-hmm. you started to introduce education. You want more education in schools, ability to understand some of the warning signs, and then monitoring computers.
Yes. Well, monitoring is very important. It doesn't explain the why. But the education about suicide, since children ages 10 to 24, suicide's the second leading cause of death.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everybody's responsibility. And we can't just put it under the rug anymore. We have to discuss suicide. And I never thought it would happen to me.
No.
I mean, most people don't.
God, no.
And it's a very, it is one of the most painful things a parent can go through.
Mm-hmm.
But because of so many things that we learned, we could have maybe had an intervention if all these things were in place about, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody hears something, they say something, and they get an adult involved. They don't dismiss someone. If these keyword alerts, it's free technology. I mean, that's a no-brainer. But so it's just all these things together, and we could, make a difference in other kids' lives.
Do you feel like schools, that the teachers in general have some of this on their radar? I would think they have some sort of training at least to identify some of the signs that might require them to say, hey, we need you to talk to the school counselor or go to a counselor.
Yes, but my son didn't show the typical signs, and a lot of kids, he didn't look depressed. He didn't... He just didn't fit the typical mold, and a lot of kids don't. They hide it. They hold it in. But if somebody, if they give a warning, and if somebody says, hey, let's talk about this, maybe it'll open up a window that they'll talk about it. But they won't bring it up to somebody's attention individually in many cases.
It's so sad, and if this Gabriel's Light, with what the work you're doing, can help other kids, God, you just hope so. 563, Anna, thank you so much for having the speaker on. Carol Dealey is her name, of Gabriel's Light, about youth suicide. As a mom of a 12-year-old myself who just got access to his own phone, I can't say enough good things about the keyword monitoring programs like BARC. It's what you're talking about. It gives us the opportunity to open up conversations with our child about what's going on in their life, helps us monitor for situations like depression and cyberbullying, all of those things that kids nowadays are facing. And often, like you're saying, probably don't always talk about it. They just sort of internalize it. In some cases, if you're being bullied, it doesn't make you feel good. You don't always go and say, hey, mom, hey, dad, hey, teacher, this is happening. doesn't always work that way.
That's correct.
So bark is free. Does it need to be? Another question. 708, is it hidden on a child's device? That's the question. An app you download, or is it software? How does it work?
It's an app, and it can be hidden. And when I put it on my youngest child's, I didn't tell him it was there, but eventually I did. Mm-hmm. My other kids, I told them it was there. And it's not that I look at everything on their phone and I don't want to, and I couldn't have the number of hours in the day for everything that they do on their phone. It just gives you a quick glance, and you only see the dangerous things.
Yeah, it seems like a very useful, helpful tool. So mm-hmm. it's happy you introduced me to that, and maybe others as well. Carol Dealey, mm-hmm. Gabriel's Light, if people would like to find you and maybe get involved in what it is you're doing, how do they do that, Carol?
They can reach out to us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and on gabrielslight.org.
Thank you, Carol. Thanks for sharing your story and for the work you're doing. And I'm so sorry for your loss. And I know you're trying your best to take that heartbreak and turn it into something positive. So thank you for what you're doing. Much more coming up here on WGN Radio. We've got trending topics ahead here. It's 2:43. All right, Lauren Lapka has stepped into the studio here as we talk about what's trending across the Chicago area, what people are caring and sharing about. Did you see this thing, Lauren, about Gail King?
Yeah, it's kind of everywhere on Twitter right now.
Isn't it? It's just, you don't see this kind of thing all the time,
no.
Right? It's somebody kind of lashing out at their employer for what they did. Here's the deal. During an interview with WNBA player Lisa Leslie about the legacy of her friend Kobe Bryant, Gail King was talking with her, and she brought up kind of a sensitive topic. She asked about the rape charge from 2003. Mm-hmm. And she's like, does that in any way taint his legacy? Does that have an impact on his legacy? They were talking about his impact with what he's doing with women in basketball, and she brought that up. And she says the clip that the network took and then started promoting across multiple platforms, well, that was a real problem for her. Here's Gail King speaking out against her employer.
I know that if I had only seen the clip that you saw, I'd be extremely angry with me too. I am mortified, I'm embarrassed, and I am very angry. Unbeknownst to me, my network put up a clip from a very wide-ranging interview, totally taken out of context, and when you see it that way, it's very jarring. And yes, we talked about that court case. And I wanted to get Lisa's take on it as a friend who knew him well. So for the network to take the most salacious part when taken out of context and put it up online is very upsetting to me, and that's something I'm going to have to deal with them.
I don't know if you saw it. I think it was it over the weekend or Monday when you'd actually cross? And I remember the way that they were promoting it was something like Lisa Leslie comments on his legacy being tainted or something. Mm-hmm. The way it was sort of projected felt like Lisa Leslie firmly believes that it's a big part of his legacy. And that's not what she said. She actually said, I've known Kobe since I was a teenager. And for me, it's not a complicated issue at all, responding to Gail saying, is it complicated for you as a woman, as a WNBA player, to process this kind of thing or to see Kobe in both of these lights? And she says, it's not complicated. I've never, ever seen him be that kind of person that would do something to violate a woman. That was just not the person I know. And she went on to talk about he wasn't that guy. He was asking people, can I meet her? Can I be with her? She said, I saw that kind of guy, and he was not that kind mm-hmm. of guy.
Yeah, I would be furious, too, as a journalist.
You see that when it's like, I think I've witnessed this before, when you take something that's kind of a complex issue and then it's reduced to a headline or it's reduced to a promo, that it isn't always quite right, and sometimes you feel bad because you've talked to the people who are part of that interview, and whether it's mm-hmm. a celebrity like Lisa Leslie or if it's just anybody, and then it gets reduced to that little quick headline and you think, that's not quite right. You know, it isn't quite how it is, right? So that's what she's saying. I just think it takes a lot of guts to speak out against your CBS.
Yeah.
I mean, she's their star, right? Steve Bertrand is also in the studio here. You have thoughts about Gail King saying this? You a little surprised by this?
You know what? I just walked in. I didn't hear it.
Okay.
Sorry.
Gail King is just talking about the Lisa Leslie interview and Kobe Bryant.
Oh.
And she's basically saying that the way the network, her own network, CBS, handled it and promoted it.
It was like clickbait.
It was clickbait. Right? It was not fair.
Yeah, it was not fair. They made it look like she
was instigating
a tough topic.
Oh, right. I know what you mean about being the face of the interview and then you take it back to your editors, and then you lose control of it, but all the subject knows is you.
That's right.
And mm-hmm. then they kind of blame you for it. Are you worried about that?
And you kind of are to blame in some ways. I mean, I felt personally responsible if it gets teased in a certain way. I'm like, that's terrible. Pull mm-hmm. that. That is not really what it is.
Right.
And then you change it. And it's a big deal, but it's important. So I get what she's saying. I just think it's pretty gutsy to go out and say. But she's got Oprah protection, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like, just go ask Oprah.
She's got the Oprah cape.
She's got the Oprah cape. She's fine. All right. Prosecution rests their rape case against Harvey Weinstein. And that's not before, though, they made all the jurors look at naked pictures of him.
Oh, gosh.
I
why?
Know. I know. I know. That's quite a visual. They also, they said that 7 images were approved and prosecutors could show them. They believe that it corroborated testimony of the movie mogul's assault because he has identifying characteristics on his anatomy.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So they were able to all look at the Harvey Weinstein photos. In fact, they had to. That was part of their job as jurors. I'm sorry. Naperville Axe Throwing Lounge is seeking a license to serve beer and wine. Have you guys been to the axe throwing place?
No,
I don't get this.
I have finally gone to one. I went to one over the holidays when my family was in town. It's a lot harder than you'd think. It is. Don't mix alcohol. I think that's a bad idea for sure.
Is it? Is a real axe? Is
it? Yeah,
axe?
It's like a little hatchet.
And it's sharp, and if it hit mm-hmm. somebody, it would hurt somebody.
Oh, yeah.
And should there be alcohol with that? Well, Naperville is taking a look at that. They want the city's permission. They say, hey, we've got the axes. Now we want beer and wine.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I actually purposely moved behind or to a different area every time my dad went up because he's known to be a little clumsy. So I was terrified that he was going to kind of bring it back to throw it, and uh-huh. it would slip out.
That's it.
Backwards. Yikes.
Yeah, that's what you're worried about.
Yeah. So
did it slip out? How did
you
do?
No, thankfully, no.
He did okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No one else in the... I would just think if you're in a... Is it a big room with other people doing it, too?
The one I went to, it was just 2 little sections, so it was a small room, and you have about 8 people at a time mm-hmm. during a session, and because you... Only you have an instructor up there, and he only lets you go up there to throw if he's up there.
Okay.
There's like a lot of strict rules.
Okay. That's good to know.
I've seen all kinds of videos of different places.
Okay. Well, good luck getting your liquor license at the X Zone. We'll see what happens there. United Airlines is buying a flight training school. Did you hear about this? They need 10,000 new pilots. They're saying there's just not enough to fulfill the needs over the next 10 years. They're going to need 12,500 pilots are going to retire in the next decade from United. And they don't have enough people.
It's a pretty good idea, though, to run your own pilot school. You know, then you can control it much better.
Mm-hmm. And kind of
control costs.
And get some candidates in the pipeline.
You get the pilots to pay you before you have to start paying them.
Yeah, right. Perfect. It's just fascinating to see that. But Boeing says 131,000 commercial pilots will be needed in North America in the next decade. China's coronavirus, the doctor who blew the whistle on the whole thing posted something on social media about seeing patients with a, quote, SARS-like new virus linked to a Wuhan food market. He has died because of his exposure to his patients, and he's only 34 years old.
I thought they changed that, and he was just in critical condition.
Was he back? Well, this has just come out this afternoon.
In fact, while I was sitting here, I got an alert that he passed.
Yeah. He did officially pass. Yeah. Wow. Because I know at first it was like controversy over, wait, no, he didn't die yet, he's in critical, and now vice versa.
Well, he was reprimanded by the government for putting it in the public radar, and he was very outspoken about it. This is something
That's
we need
awful.
To be watching, so I feel bad for him. Hillary Clinton explaining why she opened up about her husband's affair. There's a new docuseries on Hulu, I believe, and she's just a 4-part documentary. She sat down with Ellen DeGeneres and explained why she allowed the talk of her husband's affairs.
Wait, so Hulu, Ellen's not doing the Hulu series, right?
No, Ellen was just interviewing her about it. Says, hey, why'd you agree to this? And why did you allow this kind of thing to happen? And she said, well, you know, I got on board and then they asked me, can we talk about the affairs? And she agreed to it.
Once I agreed to cooperate, the director said, well, we're going to talk about everything. And I said, okay. And yet when it actually came time, yeah, it's hard. You know, as I said, when I was talking about the book Chelsea and I wrote, the book of gutsy women, that, you know, staying in my marriage was the gutsiest personal decision I ever made. And so for me, revisiting that, talking about it, for my husband also to agree to be in the film and then also to be asked, made it a bit difficult. There's no doubt about it.
I'm kind of surprised she's doing it. I am. But she's out there. She said she allowed her marriage and everything to be game for that whole thing. This is my favorite trending story of the day today, guys. A Chicago sixth grader gets Super Bowl surprise from Roger Goodell. So here's the deal. He was trying to be one of those 30-some children who were bringing, remember the kid who was bringing the ball, and it went from the commercial to the live, and that like star kid football player, I'm forgetting his name, but he ran it in, he had the really cool hair, and he ran in the ball to start the game from the commercial. Well, apparently there were like auditions and all kinds of stuff to try to be one of those 32 kids selected to be part of that running into the field, and he didn't get it. So he wrote a letter, Danny Spesky is his name, and he wrote a letter to Roger Goodell saying, you know, I didn't get it, I got rejected, and he got an autographed football from New York Giants running back Saquon Barkley.
Well, that's nice. Aww.
So he got that. That's in a handwritten letter and now from he's been Roger Goodell.
And now he's been running around delivering it to people.
Well, that, he could throw out.
Take the ball.
Yeah, really, the Roger Goodell letter? Is that really what you want? I don't know, what does that go for on eBay? $5? I don't know. Anyway, it's good for Danny, though. It's kind of cool that he decided to write a letter, follow up, and it worked out for him, right?
Isn't that cool? You never know.
Yeah. So we talked about it every day, playing Madden together, and we dreamed together because of you and the contest Danny wrote. So it was this really heartfelt letter. And then they said, you know what? This kid deserves something. That's so cool. Chance the Rapper, Common, they're going to headline the celebrity game rosters on the All-Star Weekend, the NBA All-Star. In Chicago.
Ooh, cool.
Next weekend, right?
Yeah.
14th, the 16th. It's going to be the center of the universe for the NBA and all things basketball. That's going to be pretty cool. All the celebs who will be here, right?
Mm-hmm.
They put the banners are going up outside the United Center, and they're really getting ready for, you know, the big game. It's going to be pretty cool to check it out. You going to head out there, Lauren?
I wish. I don't have tickets.
I don't either.
Maybe I do have a press pass, so we'll see
what that does for you. All right, that's going to wrap up Trending Topics. We're going to check in with Ro Khan, see what's coming up on his show, and, of course, the news at the top of the hour from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.